right. This case is Texas Workforce Commission versus Wichita County, cause number 2-15215CV. And counsel have checked in on this case, requesting their full time for argument with Mr. Laurie to argue for the Workforce Commission and Ms. Kennedy to argue for Wichita County.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Good morning.
Morning.
May it please the court, the purpose of the Labor Code's unemployment benefit provisions is to provide a means by which someone who is not working or earning wages can support themselves. TWC's position advances that goal. The TWC's position is also consistent with the plain language analysis of the Labor Code. For this reason, the TWC submits that the trial court erred when it denied its motion for summary judgment and asks that this court reverse that judgment. Your Honors, the three key issues that are before the court are, first, was Ms. White unemployed when she filed her claim for unemployment benefits? The second, was she qualified to receive unemployment benefits when she filed her claim? And the third, are there any exceptions that would render her disqualified from receiving unemployment benefits for any reason? In order to evaluate these issues, there's a couple facts that I'd like to focus on briefly. I'm not going to go through the entire facts of the case, but there's two that are important. First, Ms. White was not working and had no income when she filed her claim for benefits.
How can you be on FMLA if you're not employed?
Your Honor, the FMLA piece manifests itself in one of two ways. To answer your question, you can be unemployed under the Labor Code while you're on FMLA leave. But the FMLA issue would manifest itself in one of two ways. First would be that there is some provision in a statute somewhere that says that if someone is on FMLA leave, they'll be disqualified from receiving state unemployment benefits. And there's no provision like that in the Labor Code. And there is no provision like that in the FMLA. So that first part doesn't apply. The second piece would be that there is something about being on FMLA leave by virtue of which you will be disqualified from receiving unemployment benefits under the Labor Code. And that could mean that the person's not considered unemployed or that they'll be disqualified by virtue of their separation. There's a process that the TWC goes through in order to determine whether or not a person can receive unemployment benefits. The first thing they look at is, all right, is this person unemployed? Because you have to be unemployed under the Labor Code in order to qualify for unemployment benefits. Another thing that the TWC looks at is the virtue of their separation, does it disqualify them from receiving unemployment benefits, for instance?
Well, the whole purpose of the FMLA is to hold someone's job while they're on leave as defined and authorized by the FMLA. And typically an employee has to use up their sick leave and their vacation time, and then they still are entitled to FMLA to be on leave for the defined purposes until the term expires. So doesn't that evidence an intent that they not be paid a salary? I mean, my point is that if someone who's on FMLA can use all of their vacation and all of their sick leave knowing they're going to be on FMLA coming up and then they can get unemployment benefits in addition, doesn't that thwart the very purpose of the FMLA statute?
No, Your Honor, we don't think so. In fact, we think the FMLA statute and the Labor Code provisions are compatible. The first half of the question, though, if they have some leave, some paid leave available to them and they use that paid leave while they're on FMLA leave.
Well, don't they have to use that paid leave?
Yes, they would have to use a paid leave, but they wouldn't be unemployed under the Labor Code's definition. Section 201.091 of the Labor Code says that a person is unemployed if they are either totally unemployed or partially unemployed. The first part, totally unemployed, is important, but partially unemployed actually does shed some light on this case as well, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But a person is totally unemployed if they are not working or earning wages. So a person wouldn't be totally unemployed because they would be getting wages while they're on FMLA leave if they had some sick leave, paid leave left over. But as soon as they stop getting that paid leave under the Labor Code, they're not working and they're not earning wages. So therefore, they are totally unemployed under the Labor Code. That doesn't answer the question of whether or not they're qualified to receive benefits. They might not be qualified for virtue of their separation. They most likely would be, or whether or not they could get benefits for other reasons, because there's other provisions that might render a person ineligible for benefits that might come into play in the situation. But as far as that threshold question is considered, is the person earning wages? Is the person working? If they're not, if neither, then they are unemployed under Section 201.091. And as far as the ongoing relationship, and I think this is what the court was getting at because of the anticipation of returning to work later, a couple points on that. The partially unemployed provision. A person could be considered unemployed if they are partially unemployed, and a person is partially unemployed under 201.091 if they are working for an employer, their hours are reduced, and their wages fall below a certain threshold. So in this situation, a person is working for their employer, their hours get reduced, they continue working for that same employer, but they're still considered unemployed under the labor code. So not only is the employer-employment relationship not terminated, it's ongoing. It still continues to exist, but under the labor code, they're still considered unemployed because they're partially unemployed. So this idea that the job can be held open or that the employee-employer relationship can continue to exist, that doesn't matter under the labor code. They're unemployed if they are not working or earning wages, or partially unemployed if they fall below a certain amount. And the partially unemployed shows that the employment relationship can continue to exist. And in the case that we cite, the Huey case, that's a situation in which there's a contract that said that when the plant Huey was a, it dealt with a plant that manufactured clothing, and at the turn of the season, they would switch from their spring line to their winter line. And they would shut down while they were switching from their spring line to their winter line. So a lot of their workers would go on leave at that time. But they would have a guarantee to return to work after the plant has been switched over. But in the contract even said that you have to go on leave during this 2 or 3 week period, and we will hold your job open for you. You could come back to work. The Supreme Court said, even though that the job is guaranteed that they're going to go back to work, and this is actually stronger than the FMLA, because the FMLA doesn't guarantee that you're going to return to work. It only says that they have to hold your job open for 90 days. The Huey case was had an even stronger contractual guarantee of a return to work at a later date. But what the Supreme Court said is because a handful of those workers, even though they had this guarantee of returning to work, they were not working or earning wages when they filed their claim, and therefore they were unemployed. So this idea that the employer-employer relationship has to be terminated, or that a guarantee of return to work for whatever reason would render a person employed or not unemployed, isn't supported by the labor code and isn't supported by Supreme Court precedent. There's two other cases that are companion cases to that. We didn't talk about it in our brief, but there are, and I have them here. There's Texas Employment Commission versus Amlin and Texas Employment Commission versus Hanson. I could bring those to the court if you'd like. And there's also another case that, not a companion case, it's the Todd Shipyards case, in which it's a similar type situation where a person was laid off while their plant was shut down, and you know the idea that they'd come back to work at a later date. The Supreme Court said in Todd Shipyards, that doesn't matter. The fact that the person is not working or earning wages when they file their claim for benefit means that they are unemployed, as that term is used under the labor code.
What's the side on the Todd case?
Todd Shipyards is 245 Southwest 2nd 371, and I have all those cases right here. If you'd like, I can submit them to your clerk.
Thank you. Southwest 2nd 271.
I'm sorry if I spoke too quick. It's 245 Southwest 3rd. I'm Southwest 2nd 371.
Thank you.
And the pin site's 374.
When you were speaking a few minutes ago, you said that Ms. White was not receiving benefits while she was on leave. When you used the term benefits, you were talking about the unemployment benefits. Is that correct?
I said she wasn't receiving benefits. I misspoke. She wasn't receiving wages when she filed.
Wages, okay. But when someone goes on FMLA, aren't they still on the employer's payroll, even though their wages are basically suspended? They're still on their insurance plan. I believe maybe they're even accruing vacation or sick days during the time that they're on leave. So aren't they receiving some benefits that are actually worth dollars?
The labor code actually speaks to that, Your Honor, because it talks about what wages are, and wages don't fit within the category of those things. They're remuneration for services rendered. And again, that's an interesting, to the extent that TWC is urging this idea that wages for work done is what defines unemployment. You see that expressed elsewhere in the labor code, even when you're talking about what it means to be wages. It's you get money for services rendered, so it has to be money. As far as insurance goes, there's a specific section of the labor code that says insurance doesn't mean wages, so it has to be cash or money in order to qualify as for wages.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. So Ms. White wasn't working or earning wages when she filed her claim for unemployment benefits. So therefore, that answers the first question. She was unemployed under Section 207.091 of the Labor Code and some of the precedents that we cite in our briefs. So the other question, though, was she qualified to receive unemployment benefits by virtue of her separation? And Section 207.045(d)(1) of the Labor Code speaks to that. It says that if a person stops working because of a medically verified illness, they will be qualified to receive unemployment benefits. So because Ms. White was stopped working because of a medically verified illness, she was qualified to receive unemployment benefits under the labor code. So that answers the two key questions, the two key issues that I presented at the beginning. She was unemployed under the labor code, and she was qualified to receive unemployment benefits under the labor code. Now, one of the things that Wichita County talks about in its briefing is this idea that she was sick and therefore couldn't work. That very well might be the case, but that goes into another issue that's decided under Section 207.021, and that's a person's ongoing eligibility to receive unemployment benefits. Just because a person is unemployed and the virtue of their separation might have qualified them to receive unemployment benefits, there's certain things that they must do in order to maintain their eligibility to receive unemployment benefits. And Section 207.021 lists those. They have to look for work. They have to be available to work. They can't withdraw from the job market, and they have to be able to work. So it's quite possible that because of her illness, she wasn't able to work, so she might not have been eligible on a week-in, week-out basis. But that's not an issue that the TWC considered in the case that is before this court. The TWC only looked at whether or not Ms. White was unemployed and qualified to receive benefits. It didn't consider her eligibility under Section 207.021. That would be a separate administrative procedure that isn't currently before the court. It wasn't before the trial court, and therefore it's not before this court. Just to say, though, just because a person is not able to work one type of job doesn't mean they can't work any job. An example that we often use is a construction worker who might suffer some really bad injury. That means he can't do manual labor anymore, but he can go and do a desk job or some other job that doesn't require, you know, strenuous physical labor. Just because you're not able to do some job doesn't mean you can't do any job. So just because she stopped working because of a medically verified illness doesn't mean she's totally unable to do any job whatsoever. And in fact, we know that she was able to work because as soon as they found a job for her, she went back and returned to work. But the first point is that issue, Ms. White's ongoing eligibility to receive benefits, was never before the TWC. It's something that Wichita County could raise. They could call up the TWC and say, hey, you know, Ms. White is not able to work. Please investigate this issue. And it would have started that administrative review process. And then there would have been, you know, it would have gone through the first level, second level, third level of the TWC. And then at that point, it becomes final, administrative remedies are exhausted, and it would have been an issue before the trial court, but it never was. So because it's not within the scope of the TWC's decision, it's not within the trial court's jurisdiction. So to the extent the trial court decided on that issue, it reached a decision over which it had no jurisdiction. And Your Honor, I want to emphasize something here, because you mentioned earlier about the FMLA and the labor code, and I don't know if I answered the question quite like I had hoped to. They're not in conflict, and in fact, this case shows that they are complementary, because the FMLA, its function is to protect a person's job who has to stop working because of an illness or because of the illness of a family member, and it did that. It served that function in this case. The labor code's unemployment benefits provisions is to provide a means that a person who can't work and is not earning wages can support themselves. It gives them a baseline level of support, and it served its function in this case. it gave Ms. White a baseline level of support while her job was being protected by FMLA. So they're not in conflict. They're, in fact, can be compatible, as they were in this case. So, Your Honor, for these reasons, we think that the TWC's the position it advances is consistent with the Labor Code's unemployment benefits provisions to provide a means that people aren't working or earning wages to support themselves. It also is consistent with the plain language analysis of the Labor Code. And so for these reasons, we think that the trial court got it wrong when it denied our MSJ, and we ask that the court reverse that judgment. Thank you.
Mr. Lowry, do you agree with the proposition that the question of the interaction between the FMLA and the Labor Code concerning the matters of this case is one of first impression?
I do agree with that, Your Honor. There's been some cases that have kind of come close, I think, but no court has ever, you know, said explicitly one way or the other if a person is on FMLA.
And you certainly believe that's properly teed up in this case, don't you?
I do, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I do, sure.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lowry. Ms. Kennedy.
May it please the court. Before I address the statutory construction aspects of this case, I want to talk about and focus on the big picture policy implications of the position advanced by the TWC today. The TWC is asking this court to radically expand family medical leave in Texas and judicially mandate paid family medical leave. The TWC attempts to do this by contorting the definition of unemployed to mean something totally removed from its ordinary common meaning. Undoubtedly, if this court adopts the TWC's strange new interpretation of unemployed to include someone who is employed and exercising their protected family medical leave rights, this court will be judicially mandating paid family medical leave in Texas and vastly expanding the financial obligations of employers and employees, both public and private, on leave. This is a policy decision that should be left to the Texas Legislature or the U.S. Congress. And to date, the Texas Legislature has not spoken on this issue of paid family medical leave. But since the FMLA's inception in the early 90s, it has required only that an employer keep a worker employed and not required that the employee be paid while on leave. The TWC's broad expansion of the Act now provides an additional unfunded mandate to employers that would require the county as a reimbursing employer to pay benefits to unemployed workers, who are not protected under the FMLA's protections. The FMLA and the Unemployment Act must be read as mutually exclusive, and I do believe that is an issue of first impression. But other legal scholars have come to this same conclusion, including the Dallas Court of Appeals Justice Myers, writing for the Texas Practice Guide. I will address three arguments during my argument. First, the lack of a definition in the Unemployment Act. The lack of a definition of unemployed in the Employment Act. Second, the TWC's continued characterization of Wichita County as a former employer. And three, the substantial evidence review conducted by Judge Brotherton in the trial court regarding Ms. White's employment status. If the legislature intended to define red as black and up as down and unemployed to mean employed, it could certainly do so. But when the terms are changed so drastically from their ordinary common meaning, you would expect to see them do so in a way that is clear and unequivocal. There is no such unequivocal statement in Section 201.091. The statute is merely circular. It references two terms, total and partial unemployment, which have already been reviewed by the San Antonio Court of Appeals in the Southside case and determined not to be the definition of unemployed. In fact, they stated that to hold otherwise would be an absurdity, which would open the door to mischief and abuse of the statute, contrary to the intent of the legislature. The words totally and partially unemployed in subsections A and B presuppose that someone is already unemployed. That's the threshold question before this court. Are they unemployed before the act ever applies to them? Eligibility is once the act applies to them, then eligibility is determined. The statute is also completely silent as to any protected leave status. The Texas legislature has not spoken on the issue of paid protected leave. And because of the silence of that important issue and the other interpretations of that section, this statute is ambiguous. In preparing for oral argument and reviewing the TWC's reply brief, a 2014 Texas Supreme Court case and other material that is relevant to this issue were reviewed. I provided those materials to opposing counsel last Thursday. The Texas Supreme Court in 2014, in the case of Jaster versus Comet II Construction, Inc., cited at 438 Southwest 3rd, 556, explained that when a statute uses a word that it does not define, the court must apply the word's common, ordinary meaning, and the first place it must look is the dictionary. Merriam-Webster defines unemployed as having no job. Similarly, Black's Law Dictionary, which was cited by appellant in their brief, in the record at volume 1, page 29 in the motions for summary judgment, defines unemployment as the state or condition of not having a job. The plain and common meaning of unemployed contemplates that the employment relationship has been terminated. The TWC's interpretation starkly departs from that common meaning and creates the absurd result that an employed worker on protected family medical leave is entitled to receive unemployment benefits, mandated paid leave. The TWC goes as far in their brief to this court to argue that the employment relationship, the employee-employer relationship, is a red herring for this court. But the existence of that relationship is at the very core of the application of the Unemployment Act. The historical legislative intent and the very purpose of the statute from its inception has been to assist persons who, through no fault of their own, have become separated from an employment relationship. And we heard that word often in the appellant's argument, separated from employment. Now, this county urges the court to follow the San Antonio Court of Appeals decision in 1989 in the Southside case, which involved a substitute teacher who was still in an employment relationship with the school district but was not receiving current assignments. The TWC's reliance that they cited here today, Huey and its companion cases, are from 1961. Those decisions and their reliance on those Huey and the companion cases, is misguided. Those cases did involve a clothing manufacturer who from 1946 to 1956 had regular plant shutdowns. In 1956, they decided to enter into a collaborative bargaining agreement in which, for certain employees, they agreed to give them vacation pay. But the people who received the unemployment benefits were not mentioned in that collaborative bargaining agreement. There was no guarantee for those employees, the ones who had less than 1 year of service with the company, there was no guarantee that they would have any hours of work or that they would have a job at all when the plant opened back up. And that was stipulated too in that case. Instead, the Southside case, decided by the San Antonio Court of Appeals, involves an employee who is still in an employment relationship and thus, we argue, is much more relevant to the issues before this court. They held that there was no definition of unemployment in the statute, even though the words totally and partially unemployed were contained in the statute at that time. They instead defined unemployed as requiring that the employee-employer relationship is terminated, and not include instances where the employee was merely idle during the existence of the employment relationship. Now, this definition, which we urge this court to adopt, it recognizes both the silence in the statute of any protected leave status, and it recognizes that there is a threshold question of whether the person is unemployed when they apply for benefits. There were some legislative changes to Section 201.091 after the Southside case, but those cannot be said to be substantive on this issue. There is nothing in the legislative materials that evidences any intent by the legislature to drastically expand the act to a new class of workers. Those who have a job, have elected to exercise their federal right to FMLA leave, and are not receiving wages. The legislative history is also devoid of any evidence of intent to create a new definition of unemployed, which vastly departs from the term's common meaning. And while we did cite in the trial court in our motions for summary judgment section 207.021, I think there's some misunderstanding about why we did so, and I want to clear that up now. Ignoring any other provision of the Act when a statute is being construed ignores a basic interpretation principle that the court must look at an entire Act to ensure that a word's interpretation is in compliance and consistent with the Act's overall purpose and legislative intent. The words total and partial unemployment that are contained in 201.091 are only seen again in Chapter 207, the benefit eligibility provisions. We cited 207.021 as an example that an employee who is entitled, an unemployed person who is entitled to receive benefits, has to register for work, be available for work, be able to work, be totally or partially unemployed, and participate in reemployment services. Those eligibility conditions, they're conjunctive, and they're meaningless for someone who is on protected FMLA leave. Similarly, the section at the heart of this case, section 207.045, that permits eligibility for benefits if the employee left work for a medically verified illness. The section itself is entitled Voluntarily Leaving Work, and it requires as a condition that the employee left their last work. Now, the county has had examples of that, where someone went on FMLA for 12 weeks, and then they had cancer or some other long-term illness and were not able to come back after the 12 weeks. At that point, once that separation occurred, those people would be entitled to leave, but they're not entitled to leave while they're on FMLA. Additionally, the TWC argued in their brief to this court that Wichita County is required to reimburse payments to former employees pursuant to the provisions of Chapter 205 of the Act. That argument likewise cannot be reconciled with the TWC's contorted definition of unemployed. Currently employed workers, by definition, are not former employees. The Act is written to require a threshold inquiry. Is the worker unemployed? If the worker is unemployed, then the question is, are they eligible for benefits? Because not all unemployed persons are eligible for benefits under the Unemployment Act.
Let me ask a question. Is there any distinction that one could draw between a reimbursing employer as opposed to one who participates in, I guess, the collection of the unemployment benefits?
That's a good question. I have not dealt personally with the private sector part of that, but my understanding is that an employer's unemployment taxes are based on somewhat the amount of payments that are made by the TWC to their ex-workers. And so I would think, while it may not be as substantial and the same as it is for a reimbursing employee like the county, it certainly has an impact, a financial impact on them, that benefits are being paid to people who are workers.
And so reimbursing employers tend to be maybe governmental agencies as well as, I guess, quite large corporations?
I think, and also nonprofit organizations under the Act are qualified under to be a reimbursing employer. They make an election.
Thank you.
The TWC framed its statement of the case to this court, characterizing the county as Ms. White's former employer, attempting to force this nonconforming case into the box created by the Act for people who had lost their jobs. Throughout the administrative process, the TWC treated this case as one where the employment relationship between the county and Ms. White had been terminated, stating Ms. White was initially fired, then that she quit, and finally, after the telephone hearing, left last work due to a medically verified illness. In the trial court, the TWC stated the county held White's job open, argued she was entitled to benefits because of the nature of her separation from work, and explain that the county must repay benefits to former employees. The TWC has continued to compare the county to a former employer, and that is an inaccurate representation of the substantial evidence in this case. Ms. White never left employment with Wichita County, and she was never terminated. We were not merely holding her job open. She was guaranteed by the FMLA that her job would not be terminated. Despite the fact that only employees are entitled to take FMLA, the TWC decided that Ms. White had somehow become unemployed, a status that would disqualify her from FMLA protection. Judge Brotherton ruled that the substantial evidence presented by the county required overturning the TWC's determination that Ms. White was entitled to benefits. She was employed when she applied for and received unemployment benefits, and she was under a physician's order not to work. The substantial evidence presented to the trial court was that her physician had said she was unable to work until November the 4th. It was on November, just because she could come back on November the 4th does not mean that she was able to work during the period of time before that. Her physician placed no conditions on that restriction and said instead that she was unable to work. On the day that her physician released her, we put her back to work in an accommodating position as required by both the FMLA and the Americans with Disabilities Act. Her employment with Wichita County was never terminated. We valued her as an employee, as is evidenced in the record. And during her entire FMLA leave, she was unable to work. While she was on protected leave for a medically verified illness and unable to work, she had not left work as required by 207.045 of the Act, but was still employed. As a result, she was not entitled to unemployment benefits, and we ask that Judge Brotherton's decision in the trial court be affirmed. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Kennedy. Mr. Laurie.
I'd like to start off by addressing a point that you raised, Chief Justice. The difference between a reimbursing employer and a charged employer. There are two ways that the unemployment benefits get funded. For private employers, they pay a quarterly taxes, and for reimbursing employers, they pay a dollar-for-dollar amount to any unemployment benefits paid to their employees or former employees. Reimbursing employers don't pay taxes, though, so there's an advantage to being a reimbursing employer. Charged employers' accounts are not impact. Well, let me take a step back. A charged employer, their tax rate, the percentage that they have to pay, goes up or down based on their turnover. But if a charged employer's former employee leaves because of a medically verified illness, that's an exception. It won't affect their tax rate. So only reimbursing employers would be impacted by this. And that's a kind of a cost they pay of being a self-insured employer. They don't have to pay the taxes, but any benefit that does get paid to one of their former employees, they do have to cover. So that's the distinction, and I hope that clarifies some points there. So wouldn't it be an unfunded mandate? It's just part and parcel of being a reimbursing employer. Let me talk now about what the Labor Code says. In Section 209, and whether or not it provides a meaning, a definition for the term unemployed, this is what it says. For the purpose of this subtitle, an individual is considered unemployed if the individual is totally unemployed as defined by Section A or partially unemployed as defined by subsection B. That's what the statute says. It says this is what it means to be unemployed. So as far as whether or not the statute is defined or not defined, it clearly gives meaning to the term unemployed. And because this is an unemployment benefits case governed by the Labor Code, the court is bound by that definition, by that meaning. So if Ms. White fell within the category of either being totally unemployed or partially unemployed, she will be considered unemployed under the Labor Code's clear definition. This provision was added in 1995 following Southside, and to the extent we agree that it's non-substantive, and we also think that Southside probably got it wrong when it said that the unemployed isn't defined, and that's why it wasn't substantive, because the legislature always thought this meaning was supplied, the meaning of unemployed was supplied. And also, Southside is inconsistent with Huey. It's inconsistent with Amlin, Hansen, and Todd Shipyards that says that even though a person can later return to work, there's a promise of a return to work, they'll still be considered unemployed if they are not working or earning wages. Southside, in its language about being merely idle and the termination of employment, is inconsistent with that Supreme Court precedent. It's also inconsistent with TWC precedent, which we cite in our brief, which has held that if a person is promised a return to work at a later date, then they'll be considered unemployed under the statute. And that's important because the TWC is the agency that's charged with administering the...
But a promise is totally different than a federal mandate.
Well, there's nothing in the statute that says that this federal mandate guarantees a return to work. In fact, it only promises that the job will be held open for 90 days. The contracts in Huey going back to the dichotomy that I talked about, there's something in the FMLA or somewhere else that says that a person won't be qualified for unemployment benefits, or there's something by virtue of being on FMLA that would render the person not unemployed or employed under the labor code. And there's no provision that says that, you know, if someone's on FMLA leave, they can't qualify for state unemployment benefits. And there's nothing by virtue of the FMLA itself that says that if you're not working, because the test is, are you working or earning wages? And if you're not working or earning wages, then you'll be considered unemployed under the labor code. And there's nothing in the FMLA or nothing special about FMLA leave that means that a person is working or earning wages under the labor code. And when you talk about, you know, the promise of return to work, that's similar to what we see in Huey, Amlin, Hansen, Todd Shipyards. There is a promise, maybe even a stronger promise, because it's a contractual guarantee that you will return to work, than FMLA, which isn't that guarantee. You're not guaranteed a return to work. If they can't find an accommodating position after 90 days, you just won't return to work. Whereas the Huey in the other cases that we've cited and discussed.
Well, you're presuming FMLA based on a verifiable medical illness. There's a lot of other reasons for FMLA that don't even require an accommodating position. The person's going to come back to their prior post.
But either way, if after 90 days, FMLA no longer protects that person's job.
Correct, yes.
And so
we're talking about the 90-day period.
Right. But the promise to return to work doesn't, going back to that promise or guarantee to return to work, that doesn't by virtue of the, doesn't render a person not unemployed under the labor code like the Supreme Court in Huey, Huey, and some of the other cases we've cited has said that guarantee or promise to return to work doesn't mean that at the time a person files a claim for benefits, if they're not working or earning wages, they're not unemployed under the statute, under the labor code. So that guarantee to return to work doesn't change the nature of that person's situation when they file a claim for benefits. If they're not working or earning wages, then they are unemployed under the labor code's definition of unemployed. And that does answer some of the other questions that might come up later during the claims filing process. The nature of their separation might disqualify them from receiving unemployment benefits. They might be ineligible for some reason. So that doesn't answer the question of whether or not they, in fact, get benefits. It just answers the question of whether or not they're unemployed. And in order to answer that question, the labor code, since this is a labor code case, the labor code will supply it. The labor code supplies that meaning of unemployed. And so, Your Honor, for these reasons, we think the TWC's motion for summary judgment should be granted, and we ask the court reverse the trial court's judgment. Thank you.
Before you leave, I'd like you to comment on what was some, at least raised in footnotes, about the amount of money that could be involved in a decision if it is determined that the state's position, that your position is correct. Is there any information or any evidence in the record that relates to what's the dollar amount involved in a determination that's made that Ms. Whiteman's entitled to be the beneficiary of dollars paid under the labor code?
Are you asking about Ms. White specifically, or are you asking about the overall policy?
I'm asking about the overall policy.
Certainly. This is a circumstances that are before the court are very, very unique and very rare. They would only apply to a person who works for a reimbursing employer who has no paid leave available to them. So if for the vast majority of the state employers are charged taxed employers, their rates will not be implicated one way or the other, because their tax rate's not going to go up if their employee stops working because of a medically verified illness. Another reason that an employer's account is protected is if a person stops working because they have to take care of a sick child. That's another reason. There are other reasons that protect an employer's account. So if a person that works for a charged employer takes FMLA leave, most likely, very, very, you know, in the circumstances for which a person takes FMLA leave, the employer's account is going to be protected. So this decision, a decision reversing the trial court, isn't going to impact the vast majority of employers in Texas. But that subset of employers that it would impact, it's only going to be employers that are reimbursing whose employees go on FMLA leave that don't have any paid leave left over. And so that would fit within a small subsection of even their leave. And I submit that That's a, kind of the price they pay because they're reimbursing employers. They are not taxed. They don't pay taxes. So they don't get that month, they don't get that quarterly tax bill from the TWC. So the impact of this court's decision policy-wise would be very, very small.
Thank you.
Certainly.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Laurie. Ms. Kennedy, we appreciate your briefing in this matter and your arguments today. Your case is submitted. You can leave those cases with our clerk, please. Yep. And your case is now submitted, so you are excused. Thank you.
All right. Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.